This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, North Carolina has a new governor, and Roy Cooper has started announcing his cabinet appointees. What are their chances of Senate confirmation? Governor Cooper proposes the expansion of Medicaid despite uncertainty over Obamacare and a Republican legislature most likely to disagree. Charlotte School of Law is at the center of a crisis for both the school and its students. Dylan Roof represents himself in the sentencing phase of his death penalty trial in Charleston, and Tom Ashbrook's On Point takes up residence in Diane Reem's 10 a.m. time slot. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about most of those stories and more, but we've set aside the first segment of this hour for a get-to-know-you conversation with Tom Ashbrook, who is here in town to do his Friday program from our studios. And we're having this conversation in front of a live audience at Spirit Square's Duke Energy Theater. So welcome to Charlotte, and welcome to your new WFAE time period, Tom.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you very much. It's so great to be here in Charlotte, and what a wonderful crowd. Thank you very much for having me.
You're much taller than you are on the radio.
That's what they all say.
now that Diane Reem has retired, and she was a mainstay on this station and stations around the country, we're finally able to put you on when you are actually live. You were on at 7 o'clock at night for the longest time, and you still are, but now you're on the air at 10, and it's live. And I'm just curious about how long you've been on the air. How long has NPR carried, and how long has WBUR in Boston carried On Point?
A long time, and very widely. We are on about 300 stations, which is not that different from what Diane's been on. Mm-hmm. We've been on at different times of day in different parts of the country, and in many parts of the country, same time as Diane. I can tell you exactly when NPR brought us on, because I was recruited to come into public radio in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. I got a call about 3 days after the attacks in New York and beyond. I had been a journalist for many years. I had gone off and started an internet company and done all of that jazz. On 9/11, I was on my way to Lower Manhattan to raise money for a second company. My wife called and said, turn the radio on, something is happening. And we watched on the TV in Connecticut as the towers fell down. A couple of days later, I got a call from WBUR in Boston. They had had a call from NPR in Washington, and they had said, all of our people have been working around the clock since this happened. Our towers have been knocked down in New York. We need fresh horses. Tom Ashbrook, we know you're a very experienced journalist. You're not doing journalism right now. Could you come in tomorrow and go on 3 hours a night on 500 stations starting tomorrow? And that was my introduction to full-time radio with public radio and NPR.
But it wasn't your introduction to broadcasting. I was surprised to discover that you hosted a television program in Hong Kong.
Yes, this is true.
What kind of a show was that?
Well, this was very early on. I was just out of college. I was in Hong Kong as a teaching fellow, and I got a call asking if I would help. I was on... In those days in Hong Kong, they had a show every night where you'd have a movie, and it was so old-fashioned that I would stroll out and introduce the movie before they played it. It came on at 9:30, called Studio 930. There was no teleprompter. I had to memorize all these introductions. I would go in once a week and do seven of them. And yes, if you were in Hong Kong way back when, you would have seen me every night of the week on Hong Kong television.
Why you?
It was their English language station. They needed somebody who would come on and could be articulate talking about movies, and somehow they found me, and I said, yeah.
Because you were also, your official bio says that you started at the South China Morning Post.
This is true. That was my first job in newspapering. It was a fantastic place to begin.
How did that happen, the South China Morning Post?
Well, I was in Hong Kong as a teaching fellow for the Yale China Association, and I looked around and thought, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? I am utterly enthralled with what's going on in this part of the world. This was when the Mao era had ended. Right. China was just beginning to open up. It was a very exciting time. This is years ago now. This is when the boat people were coming up from Vietnam. It was a very rich time in Asia. And when my fellowship ended, I wasn't ready to leave Hong Kong, and I was ready to sort of dive into this whole world of geopolitics and news. And so I did right there, and it was a great place to begin as a reporter. I was thrown into all kinds of stories, and honestly, I was kind of just in love with the name, the South China Morning Post. How cool is that?
I'm just curious how you think about yourself. I know you host a radio show now, but you've been a journalist, and you worked at the Boston Globe, and you've done a lot of things which we'll talk about. Because you've done so many different things, who is Tom Ashbrook in your own head?
I'm a Midwestern farm kid who had the good fortune to grow up in a time when kids who grew up on any side of the tracks thought you could do anything in this country. That was certainly what I thought. And I went out into the world, saw a lot of it, lived for 10 years in Asia, became a journalist, became deeply committed to the world and role of the journalist, took a little detour in the 90s when newspapers were, when the internet came on, and I thought newspapers are not going to survive. I need to understand this new thing called the internet, and went off and started an internet company. Was called back to journalism as a calling by the emergency of 9/11 and have been utterly committed to it ever since.
Where did the journalism bug hit you and why?
I was always just compelled by what was going on in the world and how we needed to understand it and understand it deeply and understand it factually. We needed people out there who were collecting news of the world with insight and compassion and fairness and toughness. Mm-hmm. That role just spoke to me, and it still speaks to me today. After 9/11, I thought, my God, this is more important than ever. The world is a can be a dangerous place. It can come right home. We need to really understand it. We can't be prisoners of preconceptions or cliches or stereotypes. We really need to know what's going on. And my great good fortune was that at that moment, it was NPR that called, because public radio in the years since then has emerged as this bastion, as so much of the news media has struggled economically. The listeners of public radio have continued to stand up year after year and say, we want good in-depth news, we're willing to support it directly, and that has put public radio hosts like yourself and me in a place where we still have the resources to do the job right. I feel like I'm standing on one of these islands where real journalism is still possible and is still done and is still valued and supported.
And, you know, it's supported by listeners for the most part.
Which is the best possible base of support. The people who want it are saying we want it and we'll support it. I sound like it's a pitch drive here, and it's not.
But when you look at...
Oh, Joe O'Connor, your chief, is over here clapping vigorously.
There's a bucket over there on the aisles.
There's a bucket everywhere.
That you can drop your donations into. In fact, you can't get out of here tonight without doing that. Because it's supported by listeners, and because it's grown so much, as you said, since 9/11, and the importance of it and the appreciation for it and the need for it has grown so much, why do you suppose it is that local television and network television and cable television haven't adopted at least the practices of NPR and embraced them?
I don't want to get into throwing stones.
Thank God they haven't. But
okay, I mean, they've got their own business model, and it... You know, the fact of human nature is that it's not only good and sober news that attracts ears or eyeballs. It can also be pretty cheesy stuff can attract ears and eyeballs. And if you're in commercial, all that really matters is you attract ears and eyeballs. And how you do it doesn't matter so much.
Yeah.
Our listeners on public radio want something else, and they tell us that again and again. They want serious, probing, fair, in-depth news. And so our motivations are a little bit different. Our incentives are different if you're commercial or public, if you're supported by the kind of listeners that we have in public radio. You asked who is Tom Ashbrook, and I would go to this as well. You know, I'm a kid who grew up in a very Republican part of the country and in a very religious part of the country. But it was in a time before religious meant necessarily, it was a very loving kind of serious religion. And Republican and Democrat didn't mean that we were at sword tips all the time, that we're ready to sort of, you know, have fist fights all the time. And so I grew up understanding the full spectrum of American politics and living it, being surrounded by people who were, there were liberals and there were conservatives, and they all talked to each other and they all worked with each other. And I know that whole range. And so I want to be in a place that's not driven by one political agenda or another, but is driven by a sense of we are one community that has to thrive together, has to understand the world together, even if our perspectives are different. And that is important to me. And too much of commercial broadcasting is now kind of staked to claim one way or another. We're this or we're that. We're right or we're left.
Mm-hmm.
Public radio is a place where you can, I think, look honestly at the whole, We work very hard with On Point to have a big tent where everybody feels invited to the conversation. Everyone feels heard and respected. And I'm sure that Charlotte will hear that in our work.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, for those people who are just discovering you, because you're on in the daytime now, and they're a little antsy because they've lost Diane, who retired.
People get attached.
They get very attached to the hosts. How are you different from Diane Rehm? What are you trying to bring to the table every day?
The fact is that, you know, in all these years when Diane Rehm has been on the air doing her thing, I've been on the air doing my thing. So I can't say that I've been...
you never listened.
I mean, I've kind of been doing my own show. But I know Diane and I know her style. Right. There are many things that we have in common. Diane was always devoted to giving a full airing to issues and a serious and in-depth airing. And so am I and so are we at On Point. Diane, I think, always kept the public listeners' values in mind as she pursued the news, and I think we do that as well. Are there differences? There probably are. I mean, we're of a different generation. We're of a different gender, though I don't think that mattered too much. Diane was always right out there doing the news, and I'm always right out there doing the news. You may find a little different pace in our show. There is, especially among younger listeners, a desire for a little bit more up-tempo in the pace of probing. We think a lot at On Point about value per minute, and we always want to deliver that. When you're listening to On Point, we never want you to think, gosh, 5 minutes have gone by and I haven't learned a thing. I don't mean that you didn't on Diane, but we're very focused on delivering that because we want to bring young listeners in and do to public radio. And, you know, they've got an appetite for news that moves. It moves at depth. It moves at profundity. Mm-hmm. But we keep a tempo that may be slightly different.
And you're both blondes.
Okay, all right. I don't know.
Just want to point that out to people who are on the radio. We can't see that.
Yeah, right.
You've been a reporter. You've been a radio host. You've been a newspaper person. You've been a television host. Mm-hmm. You also worked as a surveyor and dynamiter in Alaska's oil fields. I want to hear all about that.
Let's see. I had a cousin when I was in college who had hitchhiked to Alaska and went to school there. And I was a poor kid in college trying to pay my way through. And after my first year of college, I heard about the Alaskan pipeline being built, and I called up my cousin Richard and said, are there any jobs up there? And he said, maybe. So, of course, I thought, oh, sure. So I went up and was pounding the pavement looking for a job in the oil fields. They paid very, very well. And through good luck, I found one. My first job up in Prudhoe Bay on the north coast of Alaska was peeling potatoes and washing dishes 15 hours a day, 7 days a week for a bunch of bulldozer drivers who became my buddies. And then I got hooked up with a guy who was very well known on the north slope of Alaska. He had me back again and again. I was kind of the guy he would bring in to do whatever he needed. So the next time I showed up, it was the middle of... First time was summer, which in Alaska is still winter to most of us, but on the North Slope anyway. The second time, he needed a dynamiter, and he threw me into the dynamite squad, and we were building... I'm sorry for the environmentalists, but we were blowing up mountains to make gravel for oil pads in Alaska. Sounds terrible now, but... That was the job. I was just a kid. Forgive me. And we did a lot of very, very large-scale dynamite work, and they needed a surveyor's assistant, so I jumped into that role to lay out those big airfields, and we just right on.
Tom Ashbrook is our guest. He's the host of On Point, which airs now 10 in the morning, 10 to noon on WFAE every day, and again at 7 o'clock at night, and he will be joining our roundtable of reporters when we come back for our local weekly news roundup. Stay with us.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Mecklenburg Library's Get Ready with Words, encouraging success in young children through vocabulary building. Parents and caregivers can teach a child words of the week at getreadywithwords.org. And from St. Mary's School in Raleigh, educating girls grades 9 through 12, welcoming prospective boarding families for overnight and visitation day January 16th and 17th, online at sms.edu. 2017 may be a year of groundbreaking, heavy lifting, and ribbon cutting for Charlotte's transit system. The next leg of the Blue Line is about to open. Construction will soon begin on a new phase of the city's streetcar line, and transit officials are forging ahead with ambitious plans for additional rail lines. That's where the heavy lifting comes in, because there is no clear funding source. We hear from the CEO of CATS about all this when Charlotte Talks, Monday morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Obamacare showdown, Russian hacking hearing, terror in Istanbul, Mariah Carey's New Year's meltdown. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point, live from Charlotte from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local weekly news roundup today from the Duke Energy Theater at Spirit Square with a live audience. Because Tom Ashbrook, host of On Point, is in Charlotte to do his show today, and he's also here because this is the first step in a nationwide listening tour. What do you hope to be hearing?
Mike, it's great to be here in Charlotte. It's just fantastic. And we announced this listening tour just after the elections. Mm-hmm. People sat back at the result of that election. Many fought hard for it, worked hard for it, and believed it was coming, and they got it. Many others thought, what on earth has just happened? We don't know. The whole country seemed a little bit surprised with itself and what had just happened. And we thought, it is time to really get out into all of the member stations, and many of them who carried us, and talk up close and personal with people across the political spectrum about the moment that we are at, what it means for this country, how they understand the divisions in this country politically, and how this country moves forward. That's what we're all about, and Charlotte's our first stop. We're great to have it here.
Well, nice to have you with us, and we are joined by several other people today, by WFAE's Tom Bullock, a reporter for us, and Doss Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, contributor to NPR, NBCBLK, and WCCB News Rising. There are too many letters in your bio. Also back with us. Let's start with our new governor, Roy Cooper. He's the 75th governor of the state of North Carolina, sworn in just after midnight on January 1st. What have we heard from his predecessor, Pat McCrory, since he left office? Mary Curtis?
Well, our outgoing Republican governor, Pat McCrory, did not go gentle into that good night. In fact, his tone was more like, you don't have Pat McCrory to kick around anymore. according to what he said, his achievements were not appreciated. It was the media's fault they did him in. And HB2, that was a terrible mistake.
It's worth pointing out a mistake that he said was still made by Charlotte,
nothing was his fault. And it wasn't really a surprise, because this is a man who had conceded only after accusing the state of massive voting fraud and saying that felons voted. And he went out signing legislation limiting the powers of the new governor.
In that exit video, he spoke of several things, but he said that he wished, quote, he could have been successful in convincing Charlotte not to start this masquerade of an issue, this manufactured crisis. Of course, he was referring to HB2, but do you also think he was referring to what may have led to his defeat, the fact that he signed that bill?
Well, first of all, Tom, you picked a great time to come listen here, because if you want to know about divided politics, North Carolina is a wonderful place for it.
We get that impression, even from far.
It's fascinating, because he does say that it played a role in his defeat. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating that he continues to blame this idea of the left, of these radical, in his views, these radical social views, and Charlotte in particular, for House Bill 2, even though he signed it so quickly. This is a law that was passed, entered, debated, and passed all within 12 hours. And what's also fascinating is, would not go gently into that good night. It took 2 minutes before, he started blaming the media, as Mary just pointed out. But it was fascinating watching him do this as he's sitting in front of a fireplace with a sweater on. It was a really odd thing.
And it was a warm midnight. It was a warm night that night.
But what is fascinating to me, though, is I think it's becoming more difficult for Republicans in particular, and I think Pat McCrory may be the last one to do this, to mention the bathroom issues, as I say with air quotes, as they like to say it, that to say it is only an issue driven by the left, because on Thursday you saw a similar bill introduced into the Virginia legislature. Texas looks poised to do the exact same thing. So if you look at this, no matter who started it, depending on your personal point of view, the backlash is actually being driven now by conservatives, not liberals.
I don't want to dwell on the past here for too much longer, but what happened, do you think, Ann, with Pat McCrory? Because he was the mayor here for 14 years, a very progressive mayor, on the cutting edge of a lot of development and the transit, the light rail line and things like that. He got to Raleigh and everything changed. What happened? Do you know? Do you have any theories?
You know, I don't know. You can always talk about somebody rising to their level of incompetence, and that's not to say he was incompetent at everything.
No, that's what the Observer editorial board said.
But his political, perhaps his political level, he was, even people who didn't vote for him, I think, liked him while he was in Charlotte. He was able to connect on a local level. His kind of folksy style seemed to work, and he got to Raleigh, and it just didn't seem to work. It came across as clumsy when he brought out the plate of cookies for, I think it was teachers who were protesting, and you know, and he would just sort of that thin skin that we saw a little bit. He was always a little bit miffed at the media when he was in Charlotte, but it just played out. And then he, even though he had a Republican legislature, he had a Republican legislature that wasn't really all that crazy about anybody from the cities, including him. So he was kind of fighting his own folks, and he never really seemed to find a solid ground to stand on.
And though we talk about these other states that are following along, I think it's really interesting to note that South Carolina hasn't, even though some of their cities, Myrtle Beach, Columbia, Charleston, have similar ordinances. But Nikki Haley is quite conservative, but she really didn't let them go down this road because, you know, she's all for business development. She's a very smart politician, and she showed some leadership skills in not letting it get to that. So it's quite interesting that people think of South Carolina as more conservative, but Nikki Haley was a very different kind of governor.
Tom Ashbrook, we always thought of ourselves, most people in North Carolina, I think, thought of themselves as being part of a very progressive state, not like the Deep South. We did things differently, and we had a great educational system. We were forward-thinking. We were progressive. And I think that the rest of the country saw us that way. What do people in Massachusetts think of when they think of North Carolina?
Well, you don't have to limit it to Massachusetts. I mean, we hear from people across the country, and they look.
We don't want to hear that, Tom.
Sorry.
Let's limit it to Massachusetts.
Well, I'm sorry, but we're hearing from a little bit wider net. But you are right. North Carolina has had a reputation built over 20 years in particular, I guess, as a very moderate, purple, maybe even progressive. In Charlotte, you'd look at it that way, as a place in a way where you had your great universities that people always thought as cultural leaders here. You had Charlotte and beyond, where the business of North Carolina seemed to be business, not kind of retro cultural issues. And so I think there's confusion about, wait a minute, did we misunderstand North Carolina? We thought you were sort of out front, progressively leaning forward, and there's something else going on here in a very big way. And just how fiery it's been, yeah, I think has been kind of a shock to much of the rest of the country.
Well, let's talk about Roy Cooper, who was sworn in at midnight on January 1st. He's announced, as Donald Trump has, some of his cabinet appointees. They're trickling out, his nominees at least. The first two are Michael Regan, his pick to run North Carolina's Department of Environmental Quality, who previously worked for the EPA and the Environmental Defense Fund, and Jack Trogdon to be Secretary of Transportation. Tom, let's talk about Michael Regan first, because it's been a tough slog recently at our Department of Environmental Quality.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Mike. And what I think is interesting is the parallel, the similarities you just brought up between Donald Trump's appointees and Roy Cooper's appointees, because for the first time in a long time, and the General Assembly has always had the power to do this, but they're really changing things now, they will have the ability, they've mandated that they will have the ability to confirm or not confirm Roy Cooper's picks for his cabinet. In the past, it had basically been set up that the governor gets to just pick who they would like, and that's the person who takes that seat. So if you look at someone like Michael Regan, if you are looking from the left, what you're seeing is, wow, this is a guy who, you know, he worked at EPA for 10 years, as you said, Environmental Defense Fund, working on clean energy. These are active groups that support things like, you know, climate science shows that climate change is real. These are the kinds of people that go out there and say, we have to start, you know, carbon taxes, maybe a good thing. We need to support clean energy. These are the kinds of things that can easily put a target on your back when you need to be confirmed by the General Assembly of North Carolina.
Yeah.
And that's, or I should say the North Carolina Senate, especially when you consider this. The it's not that they're necessarily, let's say, with the climate change, not necessarily climate deniers. Obviously, you're talking about 50 people. They'll have a diverse point of view. But consider the shoreline report, the impact of sea level rise report that came out a few years ago, and how they changed that timeline to make sure that they couldn't focus on a 30-year window of what sea level change would bring, mm-hmm. and how to do a much shorter window because they found those results to be more palatable. That's the kind of thing that we could see play out here.
So he may have a tough time getting confirmed. Yeah. But you reported recently that Trogdon, I'm trying to find his first name, Jim Trogdon, who also served as NCDOT's COO, may be the less contentious one. He has a relationship with the legislature, does he not?
He does. And, you know, for residents here in Charlotte, there are already groups that are up in arms, to say the least, because this is a guy who was the COO of NCDOT until 2013 when he stepped down. But that also means he's had a direct hand in programs like the toll road that is being built on I-77.
Yeah, he took a position as vice president of an engineering firm that worked with or for Cintra, which is the company that signed the contract which will be running the toll road.
So if you think we're ever going to have some kind of resolution on this road, I'd say stay tuned.
Well, he made no bones about his support for the toll road. Governor Cooper said he would never have signed the contract in the first place.
But he hasn't said that he would stop the contract. And there is that bright line that, you know, politicians and lawyers in particular can really walk. So I'm still waiting to see. I don't think we have necessarily a definitive act one way or another, or definitive statement one way or another, from Governor Cooper.
On Thursday, Governor Cooper named Eric Hooks to be his head of the Department of Public Safety. Talk about him. What do you know about him?
Not a lot. I mean, this is likely to be one that can easily sail through. This is someone who's had years of experience with the SBI as an investigator. He's worked on public corruption cases. He's worked on public safety, Homeland Security. Of the three that we have so far as of Thursday, he seems to be the one that should sail through.
Is it fair to say that at least one or two of these nominees will not make it through because the legislature will want to make a statement?
I don't know. I can't answer that question yet. We don't know. I think you can expect something of a fight. I mean, we're talking about a governor who's been in office now for, you know, less than a week, and a legislature that's not even sworn in to session until next Wednesday.
Right.
And how many lawsuits can we already count that the two have filed against each other?
Well, let's talk about Medicaid expansion then, because when Obamacare came in, when the Affordable Care Act was passed, it was passed with the hope that states would accept Medicaid expansion so that those who fell into the donut hole of Obamacare would be able to get health coverage. North Carolina is one of many Republican-controlled states who chose not to expand Medicare, and the governor at the time said that we didn't want to do it because we wanted to fix our broken Medicaid system that was already in place, and we didn't know how much it was going to cost, and the fact we didn't, and there was a sunset provision on the money the federal government was going to give the states to run Medicaid. So Governor Cooper has now said he wants to expand Medicaid. Is this the same thing? Is this to support the donut hole in the Affordable Care Act, or is this something altogether different?
And it's such a strange situation. When I spent a year covering the Affordable Care Act, I had to keep explaining to people that you actually hit a point at which you are too poor to get any assistance.
Right.
Because that's how it plays out, is if you don't expand Medicaid, you have this whole group of low-income adults who get nothing. So I think it's no surprise to have a Democrat come in and say, we're going to take this federal money. The vast majority of it is paid through with federal money. This is going to get people health care coverage. But the state legislature had already passed a law saying the governor can't do that because that had happened in other states. So Roy Cooper, again, to this, you know, keeping your scorecard on who's suing whom, the governor came in and said, I know it's against the law. I think the law is wrong. I'm going to do it anyway. So,
and yet Obamacare is most likely going to die very quickly.
Well, this is happening against the backdrop of Washington, right, where the Republicans are saying the first thing we're going to do is repeal Obamacare. But they've also promised to replace it. But they have no idea at this point or no agreement on what they're actually going to do to replace it. And you have a lot of folks, even in states that voted for Donald Trump, looking around saying, well, I don't want to lose my medical care.
Right.
Well, and the Donald Trump tweets were kind of fascinating. And that's always kind of like trying to interpret an eight ball. But, you know, he was promising, you know, repeal Obamacare. That's the first thing I'm going to do. And then he sends these tweets that sort of say, you know, maybe we should let the Democrats own this, let it fall apart. And that's kind of been their strategy.
And Chuck Schumer is
obstruct it and then blame the Democrats. And
Obamacare is essentially Mitt Romney care. And we have a guest from Massachusetts.
Ah. Yeah.
I think you've mentioned that.
Yeah.
where Romney Care went into effect long before Obamacare, and I know that you cover national information on your show and not so much concentrating on what's happening in Boston or the surrounding areas, but was it successful?
Yeah, I think Mitt Romney was very proud of the introduction of what was the template in effect for Obamacare. And it wasn't just Mitt Romney. The idea of the individual mandate, which ultimately came in for so much criticism, had lots of roots in the thinking of Republican think tanks. It wasn't just that Mitt Romney pulled that out of his hat. But, of course, he was Republican governor of Massachusetts. He introduced it there. It was successful before Obamacare. There was pride for some time before it became the big cudgel. That the Republican governor of the state had been the one to introduce it. And now some sense of irony and dismay as it looks like it's going down.
Roy Cooper made a speech the other night and made a pitch to the hospitals to help get this passed, saying, what if I told you we have the opportunity to bring $2 to $4 billion a year in investment to the state? What's he talking about here?
Well, this is the federal tax dollars. Just to let's break down the numbers into specifics. Until this year, forgive me, the federal government would pay 100% of the expanded Medicaid costs. And Medicaid, again, is the insurance for poor and disabled. Starting this year, it drops to 95%, which leaves states on the hook for 5%. And then it sunsets down until 2020 when the federal government, if it's still in place, would pay 90% and the states would pay 10%.
Even if the federal government is still in place?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you know.
We'll see.
The odds aren't looking
right?
so
drain
good
the
right
Stay
now.
Tuned.
Exactly. So besides the 2013 law that Ann mentioned, that the General Assembly passed and Governor McCrory signed into law, that literally states specifically a governor cannot add us to Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, there's also clauses in the North Carolina Constitution that's similar to the U.S. Constitution that says we've got the separation of powers and that the ability to tax or the ability to charge up debt is only held by the General Assembly. In this case, charging up debt would be potentially agreeing to the federal government for the North Carolina taxpayers or the government to pay their 5%. So Roy Cooper came up with an idea that I thought was really unique. And I found out later that I was wrong. The idea is to have hospitals pay the 5% and then potentially have them carry that over. And, you know, to some people's surprise, the North Carolina Hospitals Association came out with a statement not long after that speech and said, that doesn't sound bad. We're not going to close the door on this.
Yeah.
And it's actually a model that is in place in other states. But the trick is since this is the first year of these contributions, we don't know if it's a model that is financially successful. The theory is clear. Hospitals would make more money because 95% of something is better than 100% a zip. But that's, you know, we still have to wait to see how that plays
out.
It's
all still a political minefield for hospitals in North Carolina, too, because they don't want the subsidies to go away. They want to keep the federal money coming in. But you do not want to be on Phil Berger's bad side in North Carolina.
Absolutely. But at the same time, you saw the Reverend William Barber and the Morals Mondays group. Actually, he was allied with some of these hospitals, even in Republican rural areas, that the folks just thought, you know, we need to do this to get our poor people to get some care. So it's really even not unprecedented in North Carolina.
Well, and also, I'm glad you brought up rural, Mary, because that's really key. In rural North Carolina, there's a problem with hospitals. Yeah. This could help keep them open.
Okay. Yeah. We have to take a break. When we come back, there are many things to talk about. It'll be the lightning round. Charter schools, among other things. That's happening at the local level, the state level, and the national level. And we have the expert on schools with us, Ann Dawes Helms, from the Charlotte Observer. And the Charlotte School of Law will come up as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls, over 75 clinicians making more than 85,000 home visits annually, providing comprehensive primary care to patients in their home, workplace, or senior community. Information and registration at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. And from Modern Fabrics, a Charlotte source for upholstery, fabric, leather, vinyl, and drapery textiles. New location now open Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, at 4450 South Boulevard near Woodlawn Road. Online shopping and details at modern-fabrics.com. The News Roundup continues at 10 with On Point, broadcasting live this morning from WFAE. Tom Ashbrook and a panel of reporters, including WFAE's Tom Bullock, go behind the headlines on this week's national news. That's On Point from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
Hi, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of All Things Considered. My first car was a 1975 MG Midget. It was this little tiny orange sports car. It was actually my mom's car, but when I turned 16, they offered the car to me. 4 days later, I got in a terrible accident and wrecked it just to pieces. Even that car could be turned into my favorite programs.
Find out more at WFAE.org. Click on the support tab for info.
Welcome back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're broadcasting from Spirit Square's Duke Energy Theater with Tom Ashbrook, who is the host of On Point, which you will hear 20 minutes from now, as a matter of fact, on their weekly news roundup. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, and Andos Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. One of the other things that the legislature did prior to Roy Cooper's arrival in the governor's mansion was to limit his powers. And I believe he's already gone to court on at least one of those limitations, and that is the one dealing with the Board of Elections. The Board of Elections used to be controlled by members of the governor's party, but now it's going to be evenly divided. Is that correct?
It's even more complicated than
that. Okay, of course.
Because it's North Carolina, and we can't legislate without a lawsuit. The lawsuit was filed almost immediately after Roy Cooper took office. Basically, what happened is in this grand special session, the legislature had to really start taking away some pretty significant powers of the governor. They argued that we should just combine the state ethics board and the state elections board into this bigger group of 8 members, and that it would significantly limit the power of Governor Cooper to be able to appoint members of that, and then also to appoint down to, you know, at the local level and at the state level, they try to split up the seats pretty evenly. I won't get into too much of detail there. But what's interesting is this is the first case that is moving very quickly through the courts. And on Thursday, we already had earlier this week, we had a judge say, hang on a second, you can't put this in place. We've got an injunction. On Thursday, another set of panel of judges basically came out and listened to oral arguments from both the General Assembly and Governor Cooper. They came back with a ruling that day saying, hey, you can't do this. This is going to continue to be an injunction. So this will have to be heard in full court. And so as of right now, the status quo remains, but the fight goes on.
And on Thursday on this program, we had State Senator Jeff Tart and State Senator Jeff Jackson on the program to talk about HB2 and how we bridge the divide between the legislature and the city of Charlotte. And one of the things that the Democratic Senator Jeff Jackson brought up, he's from Charlotte, was the fact that the Republicans have been engaging in egregious partisan overreach. And he said, yes, the Democrats are guilty of this too. When they're in power, they do some similar things. But the Republicans have really taken this a step further. You wrote a piece, Mary, in Roll Call on Thursday about this too, warning that the state of North Carolina could be the poster child for what's happening in Washington, a warning for them.
It is. You see, it's the same sort of things are happening going down the list. If you look at votes, this country is pretty split. And the same thing for the state of North Carolina between Democratic and Republican, rural and urban. Mm-hmm. This would seem to be the time to compromise. But instead, just as in Washington, they're saying, we have a mandate. We are going to have this aggressive, conservative agenda, and we're going to get it done and get it done now. And you see that happening. Well, you know, look southward to North Carolina. You can't say you weren't warned. This is the same thing that happened, that you have a state that's pretty split, but because of redistricting and gerrymandering, which they're all in the court, and the voting laws, which it's in the court, you have one party that's basically, as I said in the column, they're more interested in ruling than governing. And there's just this gridlock. And I'd say to Washington, you know, look to North Carolina and see how it's working for us.
Does anybody have a mandate? I mean, Donald Trump won the electoral college, but not the popular vote. Here we have gerrymandering, which has really controlled who is going to be in the legislature, and that all may change if special elections come into play. Does anybody have a mandate?
Sure. I mean, that's the thing, but I think the concept of mandate needs to change. You could talk about Donald Trump specifically. Yes, he lost the popular vote. But number one, that is not the system that we have. Whether you like it or not, it doesn't matter. That is not the system. But number two, who do you think his real key audience is right now? He won the election with the Electoral College. His mandate comes from the fact the Republicans kept control of the House and Senate. That allows him to have more clout, I think, than he would if, say, you know, they had lost the Senate, which, frankly, most political pundits thought they were going to do, that the Democrats would take back hold. So you can argue mandate. You just have to think about who, which mandate you're talking about. Hmm. Popular? No. His voters? Absolutely. Congress? You bet.
This is the same thing they were accusing the Democrats of doing. Mm-hmm. But when they get in, well, then it's a new ball game because it's our turn in charge. It's our ball. You could see this happening with the Supreme Court and how that nominee was held up. And many folks said that it was unprecedented for them not to at least give Merrick Garland a hearing after the death of Antonin Scalia. But they played hardball politics, and Mitch McConnell won. Mm-hmm.
And you do have the changing media scene, too, in which you can, within your circles, have this constant reinforcement that, yes, everybody thinks like us. And the other guys are not just, you know, another voice out there, you know, like Tom talked about when we all talked with each other, that they're bad, they're evil, and, you know, we do have a mandate.
And liars.
A moral mandate, perhaps a religious mandate to take charge and to fight these bad things.
And there is no truth. You see, look at your outlet and you look at your Twitter feed and then someone else looks at the rest. So we're in this post-fact world. But then it becomes really difficult.
Tom, Mike, if I may, I think in North Carolina and nationally, we see in all this that our system has always depended on some modicum of civility. Mm-hmm. And that when you strip that thoroughly away, and if you really go scorched earth, you take our entire political system onto new terrain where we have seldom operated and never operated at our best. So mandate, all right, there's a kind of a fundamental mandate, ultimately, to work together to make this state or this country successful. That's the kind of mandate that I'm thinking about in the back of my mind these days.
And you would hope that's true. I mean, it's funny to think if you go back in history, I was a child of the 80s. I remember, you know, the grand fights between Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill and all these things. And if you stop and think about it, those two actually worked together to do things that neither party particularly liked. We don't even have that anymore.
And one of the places that this divide is playing out is in education. The weakening of public schools or the lessening of the importance of public schools as charter schools come into play. And Ann Doss Helms has been writing about this in the Charlotte Observer for as long as we've all been alive. I'm just kidding.
Or less.
much less. Charter school, the number of charter schools around the state has almost doubled in recent years.
The number of students has doubled. Right,
has
more than doubled.
And that's all happened since what, 2011, when they raised the cap on charter schools?
Right, we used to be limited to 100 schools, and then the legislature said, no, we're going to open that up.
So what's fueling this?
Well, that's interesting. It certainly has some political overtones. Republicans in general tend to be more enthusiastic about charter schools and sort of their little cousin vouchers for private schools, and we have both of those going on here in North Carolina and being embraced on the national scene as well. You do have, I think, some parent choice. It is not really a tidy, cut and dried. I think you have Democrats who are enthusiastic about charter schools. You have some charter schools that work extremely well. You have some charter schools that don't. And I will point out the caveat that I hear about a lot, which is that charter schools are public schools. They're not traditional public schools.
But
not
they take money
districts.
Away from the public school system. And we have had superintendents here in Charlotte who have said they welcome the competition. I don't know whether they were being genuine about that comment or whether they were saying it through gritted teeth, but that's what they said. But are they in any way, from what you can tell as a reporter, detrimental to the future of public schools? Of traditional public schools.
Well, and that was what surprised me about these numbers that I looked up. Like you said, I've been writing about this and saying growth of charter schools in Charlotte. We have not seen an actual decline in overall Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools enrollment ever.
It's happened around the state, but not here.
Not here yet. Yeah. I mean, it's flattened out. I thought we might have that happen this year, but we actually had a little uptick. But around the state, the total number of public school students in public school districts mm-hmm. is down over the past year. So, and I hadn't really thought about that, that if you open a 600-student charter school in Iredell County or wherever, and 300 of the students come from Mecklenburg and 300 of them come from Iredell, which you can cross county lines for a charter school, you know, it's not as big a hit in a district of 147,000 students, but in a lot of these smaller districts, when a charter school takes a big bite out, all of a sudden they're seeing a decline. And when that happens, you do see you lose teachers. You may start to have that public perception that, you know, that we don't have a thriving school district. You definitely, you lose the dollars. And what the charter school advocates would say is, yes, but those dollars are following students. So, you know, we're taking your students, we're putting them in buildings that your county taxpayers don't have to pay for. But it can be a real planning challenge, especially if those charter schools are not successful. And
President
all of a sudden, kids come back.
President-elect Trump has put forth Betsy DeVos to be Secretary of Education. She and her husband have spent millions, literally millions, to lobby for changes to Michigan's public schools and have pushed for school choice and free market for charter schools. She and her husband opened a charter school in Michigan at some point in 2010. Do you think, Tom Ashbrook, if she is confirmed, that we'll see more federal support for charter schools around the country?
I don't think there's any doubt of that. And there you begin to get into this interesting terrain where, Anne is right, you've seen Republicans and Democrats in different settings who support charter schools. But there's one kind of support for charter schools which says we need laboratories for innovation and change that we might import back into the normal public schools. There is another kind of support for charter schools which you might describe as more ideological, which simply thinks that over time they should be, the education should be privatized, in part because there's a deep resentment of the power of teachers' unions and that they've wielded over time politically, in part just a kind of deeper ideological view that this doesn't need to be part of the public domain. In Betsy DeVos, I think you may see more of the latter, and Donald Trump has made noises to the effect that he could get on board with that broader privatization. That's a big change.
Have you seen any examples where things that worked well in charter schools were actually adopted by the public schools, or are public schools, traditional public schools, too encumbered by rules and regulations that they can't adopt those things that work?
I mean, Anne's probably better than me to answer that, but if you look around the country, I'm sure you'll find examples where public schools say, oh, there's something, and they've brought it back into that. I mean, that has always been the part of the idea.
Yeah.
Right.
How fluid that transfer of innovation is, I really don't know.
And yeah. I think in any kind of school, you can have great success at a school level, and often that's that combination of a great principal or school leader and the teachers and the parents who buy into it. It's very hard to take it to a large scale. You do have some national charter chains that have done fairly well. They're also somewhat more selective. But things like longer school years and calendars that was believed to be, you know, something that if we could do that, you know, if the public schools could do that, they'd be great. It's not been terribly successful.
And you just reported on three North Carolina charter high schools that say that they cannot deliver on promises of licensed teachers. Are these the kinds of problems and performance issues? Are they part of a picture nationwide, or are they just North Carolina problem?
It's one of the big differences is that in North Carolina, charter schools are only required to have 50% of their teachers licensed. And again, the idea in theory is that maybe you have a great support person who doesn't have the license but has maybe great job skills, you know, to sort of look outside the traditional parameters for teachers. And pay is different. You can have more flexibility in pay. And that was one of the things I looked at to see, do charter schools have this different approach where maybe they're paying really high for superstars and finding it somewhere else? And in fact, they're struggling to pay salaries that are even competitive with Charlotte Mecklenburg schools. I should say that the operator of those three schools got back to me and said that everything that the director of charter schools said was not correct, that in fact, they do have 100% licensed. And they're just asking for that change just in case they ever have a vacancy. That was odd.
Part of the problem, I think, too, and the controversy nationally, is over oversight. And I think that was a problem in Michigan. And in some areas, yes, the charter schools are doing quite well. In others, they aren't, or they're closing, and there are problems. So that's a real real difficulty when you're talking about charter schools good, public schools bad.
So let's touch very quickly, we have 3 minutes left, on the Charlotte School of Law. They're facing serious problems that affect the students as well, because the federal government is no longer funding their student loans. They were offered recently an opportunity to switch their enrollment to a sister school in Florida. In a report we aired on WFAE earlier this week, at least one of the students was not too pleased with that as a choice. And they were going to make a decision by the end of the week, by Thursday, actually, and it didn't happen, as to whether they would reopen for the spring semester. Tom Bullock, what's going on?
Yeah, and they've already said that due to the ban on accepting federal funds, that they can't even accept a new spring class for 2017. The short of it is the school was caught inflating. I mean, the federal government says, the Department of Education says, that they were inflating numbers. They were, in essence, lying to students, and they were doing it continually. This is a for-profit law school. That's run by a company that has, you know, three overall. And to show you just how troubling it is, Charlotte School of Law had the highest dropout rate for first-year students in the country for any law school. Number two is the school that they're offering them to transfer to, which is owned by the same company, the school in Florida that you were talking about. So these students find themselves in a really tough situation. And part of the problem was the school let in people that, you know, the Department of Ed said are probably not qualified. They're not going to get jobs in the legal field. They're not going to be able to pay back the loans of $44,000 a year or thereabouts in order to get this degree. And for those students who are pushing through, they're stuck in a really tight spot where, in essence, if they get their degree, they're likely to have to find personal loans to do it. And is it going to be worth the paper it's printed on? And no one knows the answer to that. This is the first time this step has been taken with a law school.
And there is that popular perception that a law degree equals big money, when in fact, you have to pass, you have to graduate, you have to pass your bar exam, which they're not doing at very high levels at all. But most starting lawyer jobs are not, you know, not going to let you pay off that kind of debt. Still going
to
be struggling.
I made reference to the 80s. This is certainly not the 80s when it comes to law either. I mean, when it comes down to it, the legal profession is not paying as high as it used to.
Well, I have good news and bad news. The good news and the bad news is the same thing. We don't have any time now to talk about the 18 by 18 cardboard recycling law. But I have taken that question and printed it out on an 18 by 18 piece of cardboard, and we will recycle it into next week's show.
That's good to hear.
I want to thank Tom Bullock for being here from WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call on WCCB and NPR, and Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Tom Ashbrook will be on the air moments from now with his own weekly news roundup on Point. Thank you all for the hour.
Great show. Okay, great.